pleased to have Josh Gerstein as our guest. Josh, I've known for several years, since back to the Clinton administration. He worked for ABC News, and now he's working for Politico. No matter where he's been, though, he's always been interested in legal issues and in bringing that element to studying the White House and studying the presidency. And Josh, I wonder if we could start off first with your telling us how you got into the business. What, where did you go to school? What did you study?
I went to Harvard, and I majored in government, which is like political science, I think, at a lot of universities.
Yep.
And Harvard doesn't have a journalism program per se, so you got to pick something else, even if you're interested in journalism. And did a few internships at the NPR station, WBUR, uh-huh. in Boston, for 2 or 3 summers. And then did one at a TV station in Boston, and then eventually got one at ABC News in New York, like the summer before I graduated, and ended up going to work right after I graduated at CNN here in Washington, just after it moved down to First Street. It's near Union Station. And worked in their investigative unit as a researcher and a associate producer for about 3 or 4 years, and then went to ABC, where I was sort of investigative producer, covered the Dole campaign as a what we now call an embed in 1996 for ABC. It wasn't called an embed back then, and then came to cover the White House in 1997 as an off-air reporter producer for ABC, covering the last term of Bill Clinton. Eventually started doing some on-air work and became sort of the weekend White House reporter, and covered a few other things as like an on-air reporter for ABC from 2000-2001. Covered the first year of Bush from the White House for ABC, then was thoroughly sick and tired of Washington and went to China for 2 years. I'd actually been trying to get out of Washington for a while, but they kept like upgrading my position, so it was hard to leave, and then eventually I was just like, no, I'm leaving. So I wanted to get far away from Washington and went about as far as you could go to Beijing in 2001 or beginning of 2002. And worked there for ABC for about a year and a half before moving to California and working for the New York Sun from California from 2003 to 2008, September of 2008, when the New York Sun went out of business. And moved back to Washington in January and started working for Politico, covering the White House, but also keeping my eye on the Justice Department and legal courts, things along those
uh-huh.
lines. So there's the.
Were you able to, when you came to Politico, were you able to say, you know, I don't want to just cover the White House, that I'm interested in the legal angle and would like to do more than that?
Yeah, in fact, what I had been discussing with them for some period of time, even back before the Sun went out of business, was coming and doing something for them and the stuff that I'm most interested in, which tends to be the legal stuff, the court stuff, the Justice Department stuff. And they were interested in having me do that, but at that time they were still navigating their way through the campaign. And then after the campaign, we started talking about that more seriously. But then, frankly, about 10 days before the inauguration or 2 weeks, I got a call from one of the editors there saying, look, we do want you to do that for us in the sort of medium term, but we really want to hit the White House like with gusto, you know, when Obama comes in, and we'd like to add at least one more person who's covered the White House before, because we have a team of between 7 and, depending how you count it, 10 people covering the White House, which is pretty extraordinary.
It is.
But only, I think, one of them actually has experience. That's Mike Allen, who actually has experience covering a prior, you know, prior White House.
Except the editor, your editor.
Our editors, yeah, sure.
Craig,
so there are other people
Craig
at Politico,
Gilbert, yeah.
Gene Cummings, and various
yeah, right,
other people have
right.
covered the White House. But on the White House team, there's only one person who'd done it before, and they wanted to have at least one more person who knew the ropes and would be able to say both to our people and to the White House people, like, this is the way it was done. Are you sure we're going to change this? And insist on certain things, things along those lines.
Yeah. Well, that has been very helpful, I think, for Politico, that in a way that was something the White House itself should have considered, was bringing people in who were familiar, like the press office, of bringing in people from earlier administrations who had a sense of how the place worked, because in some ways they've had a rough start.
Yeah, kind of, I mean, we've discussed that before. I think they would have benefited considerably if they had at least even one person in the press office who had been in some prior press office. Probably the Clinton administration would be the ideal choice. I think they wanted to do a clean break and just come in anew. And of course, there's a lot of pressure to bring in people from the campaign who were very helpful and who did jobs and may have done a lot of work or may have worked without pay entirely to give them some kind of a job. So it's hard to then take a slot and give it to a ex-Clinton administration person or something like that. But the continuity is very difficult, and to just be dropped into those offices on January 20th and to think that you're going to be able to run things from scratch without having any idea how it was done before, it's not the smartest thing. And I think even with things like the Easter egg roll yesterday, I just feel like they might be more benefit to having a couple more people around that have a little more experience organizing.
Because when they came in, they came in mid-afternoon, because we were both there. I think it was around 3 o'clock or so, Gibbs.
Right.
And Bill Burton came in, and there was nobody else. And so there was nobody to tell them how to start up the computer. And so it took them some while to figure it all out, get the passwords. It's been a little rough in some areas. Well, today is a good, especially when you think of all the different things they're doing. And I think today is a good example of the kinds of things they were doing, because it's not been but about an hour since the last event that we went to, which was the introduction of the dog.
And the big event of the day.
Yeah, it was a big event of the
day. I didn't actually go out for it. I was still back in the briefing room, which was basically empty. It was like a ghost town back there.
Yeah.
Like there may have been all the most momentous announcement in the world of World War IV or whatever, and there'd be a few people sitting around eating Cheez-Its in the back of the briefing. The place was almost entirely empty. Everybody was out doing the dog.
That was true. So. But I was looking at some pictures. I was pulling up some pictures from a book that I've got of White House photographs from the announcement of the end of World War II. And all the reporters were in the press room, and I think there were about 30 people max. Today, out in the South Lawn, there had to be over 100 people wanting to record the event of the dog. But today, start with the story that you had, that you put up last night, and about the legal left, and then kind of put together how many stories you do. How do you balance them? Like, how do you do the dog, and then do the whole issue of the law and the administration?
Well, I mean, part of why I think Politico hired me and hired a couple other people, David Cloud, who came from the New York Times to do national security and foreign policy stuff. I think the Politico editors recognized that as they moved from the campaign mode to the governing mode to the administration, to simply do sort of political back and forth, the Republicans say this, the Democrats say this, the Republicans are about to drop these campaign commercials, the Democrats are about to drop these campaign commercials, that even the most insightful sort of campaign reporting wouldn't necessarily transfer to covering foreign policy, wouldn't necessarily transfer to covering what are we going to do about Guantanamo? Even when you get into that in the campaign, it tends to be at like a superficial level.
Yeah.
The editors were, I think, quite aware of that. And as they rounded the turn after November and December, we're thinking we need a few more people that can do and are interested in doing that sort of policy coverage. So it's still a balance. I mean, we have people that cover, and indeed I contribute to this thing called the whiteboard, which is almost a Twitter of what's happening in the White House at any given moment. There's a page on Politico called 44 You can go there, and there's a little white box. And what's been happening in the last hour, in the last half hour? Who's been spotted in the driveway? What's the talk in the briefing room? Is the door on fire because of some mechanical problem? I mean, it can be a very minor thing. You know, bees have invaded the Northwest Gate and are attacking the press corps and guests or whatever. Or it can be the president's about to appear to make an immediate statement on some subject. So you have that level of reporting, which is like the one-line level, to the full-scale story, which might be up to 1,200 words long.
Uh-huh.
And then you have sort of some other gradations, somewhat shorter story. You have I have a blog, so some things you put on a blog post. And then we also have something called a module, which is a story that's probably 3 paragraphs to 5 paragraphs long, like not very long, but not to be disposed of in a few sentences. So I don't know, there's discussions going on all the time with editors about what merits a line, what merits more than a line, and what merits a full story. And at any given moment, we're sort of juggling like where to put those different categories. So,
you've written a couple of stories about the Justice Department and the prosecutors and the criticism that they've been receiving by federal judges. Now, how did you come up with that, and what kinds of conversations did you have with your editors to decide how much attention that merited, and what have the results have been of those stories been?
The most recent one we did largely was a result of going to see the Ted Stevens. There was an event about 10 days ago where a judge here, it was only a week ago, it seems a little longer, a judge here had a hearing about the prosecution of Ted Stevens, and the request from the Justice Department to set aside the verdict. And I went and attended it, and another political reporter also went and attended it, and he had covered the trial, so he ended up writing the story of the day about here's what the judge said, et cetera, et cetera. And we were looking for a way to play off the story, to come up with a second story. Whenever there's a momentous event of some kind, we're often looking for, let's do a main story about the main news and a bounce piece, we'll call it sometimes. Different people have different names, words for it. So at least one of those stories you're talking about where the federal judges are fed up or something along those mm-hmm. lines was basically, I had come across for a blog post I was doing the day before a judge that had basically gone crazy on some Guantanamo prosecutors or some government lawyers in a Guantanamo case saying, that he was, she was fed up and threw the prosecutor off the case. And so I had heard about that one, and then we had seen another example that McClatchy had reported from Judge Sullivan the earlier week, also on Guantanamo, being very dissatisfied with the government's handling of one of those cases and telling the prosecutor or the government lawyer that he had to file a copy of this order in every Guantanamo case in the whole court, of which there's like 200 or something like that. So he was really mad at them there, and basically thought it would be interesting to stitch together a few of these examples and talk to some people about mm-hmm. whether there's a credibility crisis or some sort of concern judges have that the Justice Department people aren't being truthful with them. And when I talked to people, people did say there seemed to be a flurry of these cases recently. Sometimes at Politico, we tend to try to put that all into the frame of Bush screwed this up and Obama thinks he's going to fix it. And sometimes I have to push back against that a little bit because it's not always that simple, uh-huh. that framing. I think it's very common tendency for Politico to try to put things in that framing, Bush versus Obama. Sometimes it doesn't quite fit, and a lot of the stuff with the Justice Department, it's not quite that simple. I mean, the public integrity section did not prosecute Ted Stevens, who was a very senior Republican senator, because it was in President Bush's interest to harass a senior senator and get him driven from office on the verge of an election. They did it because they thought they had a case against him. So the better case against the Bush people, if there's one to be made, is one of sort of mismanagement and arguably lax standards and things like that. It's not necessarily a political case of the Bush Justice Department did this to Ted Stevens. I think it's more complicated.
So how do you get to that, and how do you put it all together? Who would you talk to? What kinds of people?
You mean sources to get and gather information?
But just generally what kinds, not necessarily what people.
Sure. Well, on a story like that, I would call defense attorneys that I might know around town that I've dealt with on other stories, not just in Washington, but other parts of the country. I would call, especially trying to talk to former Justice Department people who would be able to tell you what's the thinking at Justice, have things changed, are people demoralized, and so forth. You try to reach people currently at Justice, but people generally are very skittish about talking in that environment. And also, they're very defensive about, you know, some of this public integrity is a very sort of insular section in a sense. So no one's going to say, oh, they did a terrible thing, mm-hmm. job, those prosecutors, they should be in jail. I think people are very concerned with injustice about that. And a lot of people feel that the judge went overboard in some of the things that he said and things along those lines. So you'd call those people. You'd call people in Holder's office, Attorney General Holder's office, or the press office at Justice to see what they say about it, because they know that this criticism is out there. You know, law professors and other people that might have insights into, you know, how to deal with it.
Mm-hmm. Where did your story come from that came out last night on the legal left? Is that an accumulation also?
Yeah, it really is sort of an accumulation. I mean, we've been looking, one of the themes since the Obama administration started on these legal stories is how different is Obama going to be? Is he going to make a 90-degree turn? Is he going to make a 180-degree turn from what Bush was doing on Guantanamo, on state secrets, on a variety of other issues? Because the campaign, he really made it sound like he was going to do a 180 on a lot of this stuff. Like, Guantanamo, we're closing it up, and, you know, state secrets, it's an outrage, and Bush has been running the Justice Department in a crazy fashion, and we're not going to allow politics over there. And a lot of sort of blanket statements get made in a campaign by both sides. I'm not, you know, McCain made a lot of, you know, blanket statements. He would never issue a signing statement on any bill, you know, for he would ban them or whatever. And so Obama tended to be more nuanced, but at least the way people received the messages, they got the sense that it was going to be a major change in direction from Bush. And so one of the things we've been watching, and I've been watching, is it a major change in direction? And the answer seems to be, aside from a change in rhetoric, I haven't seen a major change in direction yet. I've seen a willingness to have some more transparency, although primarily with your, like, predecessor's information. I mean, I'm glad to get the memos that they put out about what the Bush people thought about various issues, but that's not really transparency in its pure sense. I mean, that's transparency in its pure sense is like showing us your process. Mm-hmm. What are you doing? What's this White House doing? Not what did the old White House do? So I just think the jury's still out on some of that. So this story about the legal left is sort of a sense that I got from looking at various blogs, looking at various articles and various comments and TV programs and others, that in the last couple of weeks, a couple of events, one having to do with a filing that was made on state secrets in a case in California involving the warrantless wiretapping, and another thing that was dropped late Friday night appealing a ruling over Bagram in Afghanistan and whether prisoners in Afghanistan should be able to go to court or not, where Obama basically aligned himself in both those cases 100% with the Bush position. Some people would say that in the California state secrets wiretapping case, Obama actually took a more aggressive position than the Bush people did. And so I felt like those two incidents kind of pushed people who've been on the fence saying, you know, he's new, you know, Holder's only been in a couple months and took him a while to get confirmed. They're getting their sea legs. We got to take a wait and see approach. They're just getting their bearings, or maybe these filings weren't run all the way up the chain of command. There are about 10 different excuses we've been hearing for the last 2.5 months from sort of liberal lawyers and civil libertarians for excusing what they don't agree with that Obama's doing. I felt like with the last couple of incidents, we're getting closer to the point where more of them are saying, you know, we're disappointed. They're willing to say we're disappointed, and this is not what we think he told us they were going to do. I'm not saying it's an enormous groundswell at this point, but I think among a certain group, you see a more open willingness to say, you know, we were saying benefit of the doubt before, but we really are very concerned now that he's going off in a direction that we don't think it's what he promised.
Uh-huh. How long does an article like that take you to do?
This one? Well, I mean, it just depends what you're going to consider to be, I mean, the one about the legal left. The truth that the writing of it only took me a couple hours because I was pressured for time to do it. But, you know, that's usually after I've been looking
right.
for various sources and quotes and gathering a file on my computer where I put, you know, different chunks that could go in the story. So the writing of it, the stories on Politico don't tend to be terribly long. That one was probably in the 800 or 900 word range. At least I think we may have added a little bit to it at the end. But the bulk of the time is just, right. as we call it, gathering string for
yeah.
stories. And rather than just saying, oh, that's interesting, and throwing it away, you know, in this time with internet and so forth, I think it's a good idea to just record it, put it in some notes, and then you try to tie it. When you feel a story reaches critical mass, you try to tie it all together and push
uh-huh.
it forward to get them to put it up. And that's basically what happened with
uh-huh.
this one.
How many stories did you do today, and what kind of range? What range of information were you dealing with?
I'm working, worked primarily, well, I did one story just as we were leaving about an announcement the Justice Department made about retraining prosecutors on their duties to show information to the defense. It's like a quick hit story. There was a statement from the Justice Department, as usual, invariably at 4:50 p.m. or something like that, that they were going to do this, and this was one of the things the judge asked them to do last week at that Stevens case. He said, every prosecutor in the country, new or old, needs to be shown again what the rules are, and so this guy's an old friend of Eric Holder, and so I think he didn't have much choice but to say we're going to do that. So I did a quick hit on that. I fed a few notes from a few different events that were taking place, but primarily today I was working on another story I'm doing on the death penalty, criminal justice, and sort of some of the crime issues that we don't hear a lot about these days, but I think it would be interesting to find out, you know, again, people sort of, there's so much faith in Obama that even if he hasn't spoken a lot on issues, people feel like he's just going to change. He's Mr. Change, and if Bush did it this way and we didn't like it, Obama's going to
mm-hmm.
change it. And when you push people as to why they think that, oftentimes you don't get a lot more than just that they have faith that he's going to change it. So I just think this is another area worth
yeah.
looking at. Is he going to take a new approach on crime, on things like the death penalty? Because back in the 90s, when I sort of came of age at the White House, it's an enormous issue in the 90s. I mean,
yeah.
in that Dole campaign between Dole and Clinton, crime, the death penalty. I mean, I don't think Obama's mentioned the word crime since he came into office. If he has, it's been like...
Well, he'd had the event.
He went on and did a thing about
Ohio.
Bringing police,
yeah.
yeah, that there'd be more police because of the stimulus bill. But in terms of, like, how the government should deal with it or what should happen to people that commit crimes, I think it barely came up during the campaign and has barely come up since. And it's so striking to me as a big difference from the 90s when...
Uh-huh.
You know, Clinton was determined to show that he was tougher than...
And he had his cops program. Where
he had the cops, 100,000.
Yeah.
Joe Biden was huge
yeah.
on the cops program. He ran home to Arkansas to execute that fellow in the middle of the campaign. I mean, it was just a big deal back in the 90s. And I don't know if there's no crime anymore or people only care about terrorism crime now and not... It still seems to me you're probably far more likely to get mugged or murdered than you are to get, you know, killed by some sort of terrorist assault. So,
yeah. It looks like it's difficult covering a White House to get inside and to see how the place operates, how the president's thinking works, and In reporters that I followed, it seems that the people who are really successful in capturing an administration come in with an expertise that they can use as a thread that they pull to find out how things work, because they know their particular area. So they know who to talk to. They know how things should be working. So, for example, David Sanger of the New York Times really knows the whole nuclear weapons issue, and he knows North Korea. And so he was able to use that to get a good sense of the Clinton administration. And so what you're doing is much the same. You're using the law as a thread, as a way to get into the administration and see how it works. Because cracking a White House is really difficult to do. And if you have an expertise, you're much better off in getting a sense of how it works, because you get a sense of the president himself and what has he said earlier. Is he doing what he said he would do? And how is the issue being treated? And so it's I think that's one of the reasons that your work has been is very successful and gives people a very good view of the administration, of how it works. Well, there was a lot of stuff, different stuff that was going on in the White House today. In getting information, it seems like one of the major venues that people are using is the briefing. Robert gives a briefing each day that goes on for a good 45 minutes. Earlier administrations, they did two briefings a day, a gaggle in the morning, which was in the press secretary's office, which in the Clinton administration, when you were there, and Mike McCurry was press secretary, and Joe Lockhart, and then Jake Seward, that was a session that was on the record, but it was not transcribed, and only for people, you'd go into the press secretary's office. Dana Perino stopped that when she was press secretary, and she stopped it in September of 2008, and it has not been restarted. And so what had been a somewhat informal session, all the Bush people made it more formal.
They brought it out in the briefing room, right?
They did, with September 11th. Ari Fleischer did have it in his office, but it was transcribed.
Right.
And it was transcribed and sent around the administration.
Right.
And another aspect of it, too, was that there was a camera on the ceiling of the briefing room, so that there was not one in the press secretary's office.
Right.
So when they moved it out to the briefing room, not only was it sent around the transcript, but also you could watch it. If you were internally in the White House, they have their own television channel.
Right.
And so they used it. So he could not do any informal kind of discussion. I mean, his bosses were always watching, whether it was Ari or then Scott McClellan or Dana. They just never took it back. Tony Snow tried once one day,
right.
And there were so many people, he just decided not to try the experiment, although I think it actually would have worked. But so now everybody there's no gaggle, and if you want to get information from the press secretary, you show up at whatever time he's giving it, which was today. It was late. But ended up being, well, yesterday it was worse. Yesterday,
right.
I think it was
3-something
yesterday.
Yeah, I
right.
I think it was only about 1:30 today.
Right, that's true. Yeah, and it becomes difficult to write a story. What kind of information do you get out of that briefing? And how do you decide what kind of questions you're going to ask? Because you asked a question today.
Well, I mean, we don't always get a question. I mean, part of it is Gibbs has been very he's been very sort of restrained or limited in how far he's going in the room, as I know
right.
you've taken note of who he's asking questions of. So he makes the seats are all assigned. People don't always show up every day, so if they're not in their seat, you can just take their seat. But the first couple rows are the wires and the old TV networks, I think, and then the new, like Fox, CNN, are in that next row.
CNN is the end of the
front
row.
And then you have some radio folks, and then you have places like the Post and the Times. Gibbs, at least for the first couple months, almost rarely made it out of those first two rows of reporters, and that basically meant that everybody else. Politico was back in the fourth row, I think.
Yeah, and there's seven rows of seven seats.
So you've got a variety of people from a variety of different papers around the country. You've got some folks from new websites like sometimes Huffington Post, sometimes Real Clear Politics and places like that. You have other radio people who show up. You have foreign television networks that show up. A lot of them were not getting questions early on, and still it's been a touch-and-go kind of situation in terms of him getting out of the first few rows, which people might say, I don't care, it doesn't matter. But I think you tend to get, not always, but you get more diverse questions the more you go back in the room. I mean, the odds that the odds that the wire services or the networks are going to ask some question that might really throw the press secretary, it's pretty slim. I mean, it happens sometimes, but they're more likely to push really hard on the issue of the day than they are to bring up an issue that's not at the very top of the agenda. But the more you go back in the room, you get people that have different interests and are working on different stories and will bring up other subjects. I don't remember everything that happened today. I thought there were a few interesting foreign policy answers. I mean, I always find that a little interesting because press secretaries tend to be novices on that stuff. I mean, I don't think Robert Gibbs knew a lot about foreign policy. And then they have to go through a crash course where they learn about these sort of national security foreign policy things. There was a question asked by the Washington Times today about the in Pakistan, how they're going to allow Sharia Islamic law in a certain part of the country. And it got a pretty forceful answer from Gibbs, I thought, where he said the president doesn't think that, you know, violating women's rights or human rights is heading Pakistan in the right direction or something, which I thought was a pretty strong, you know, on foreign policy questions, you tend to get pretty constrained answers where, like, if they'll go over here or go there, but they rarely go. And I thought that was pretty aggressive for something like that. And Gibbs is usually not the one who's going to make a sort of adventurous statement, and I thought that was pretty strong. The question I asked, Helen Thomas had asked a question about this issue of prisoners who were in Afghanistan, and this rather, I think, extraordinary filing on Friday night from the Obama administration saying that those prisoners shouldn't have the right to go to court to challenge their detention, and Helen Thomas sort of asked about that and got an answer from Gibbs saying, well, there's fighting going on there. It's an active theater of hostility, so it's different from Guantanamo. And then, and so that was Helen's exchange with him, and later I followed up with him saying, you know, you're right, Robert, it is a different, there is active hostilities still in Afghanistan. People are being shot and bombs are blowing up from time to time and things, and president's planning to send more troops over there. But the prisoners who were at issue in this lawsuit that was being dealt with on Friday are not prisoners that were picked up in the war in Afghanistan. These are prisoners who were flown there from Thailand or Yemen or some other place. And the U.S. government, with its vast resources, certainly could have flown them to Guantanamo or flown them to Dulles Airport or anybody else, any other place they wanted to take these people. And they chose to park them at Bagram. I'm not saying Obama chose that, but the government, U.S. government chose to do that. So it doesn't seem to me to make a lot of sense from a moral or ethical point of view to say, like, well, because they ended up at Bagram, they have no recourse. But these guys ended up in Cuba, so they can go to court and challenge their detention. There are legal reasons you can make arguments for the difference, but I don't understand the difference in a from a moral point of view. I mean, you can argue they shouldn't be able to go to court at all. That's a totally legitimate argument, but I don't understand the distinction. You know, Gibbs sort of gave a half, another half, you know, answer, sort of saying something about that this was all a part of to allow Obama to pursue his review of the policy, and that as that review's completed sometime in July or whatever, they're just trying to get breathing room to allow the policy to be developed, and then he'll figure out what to do about the prisoners in Bagram or something along those lines. But this is a fault line that I had put in my stories the day, I think the same day Obama announced his Guantanamo policy, the day after he was inaugurated, that, you know, he was giving, he said, everybody at Guantanamo is going to get a special review by the Justice Department to see if they really should be there. And several people I talked to that day said, what about people at Bagram? What about people in Iraq? There's 20,000 prisoners in Iraq. There's more prisoners at Bagram than there are in Guantanamo. And the White House's answer seemed to be like, well, the world hasn't made a big fuss about Bagram, which doesn't seem to me to be a very logical or principled distinction. But some, if we're just saying for PR reasons we need to close Guantanamo, then I guess that's one position. So that was something I pursued with him. But again, he's only going to go so far. He knows that it's in court, and he doesn't want to make any statement that he thinks could prejudice the court case mm-hmm. in some way, shape, or form.
When you're preparing for your day, can you give us an idea? Bill Burton talked to us about his day and, you know, when it starts and what he reads. What kinds of things do you read during a day and during a week? And just kind of where do you get your information?
Well, I probably start my day most days by reading my colleague Mike Allen's playbook. Uh-huh. On.
And when do you start?
I don't know, probably around 6:30, 7, something like that. I'm not saying I start and work consistently, but I get it on my BlackBerry,
yeah,
and I
right.
usually end up looking at it soon after I wake up just to have a sense of what's going on. And I trust Mike, who's probably been up for most of the night, to have captured whatever important. I mean, I know what Mike tries to do with that. He's told me is, you know, what's happened since I've gone to sleep that I need to know about. And that's sort of exactly what I'm looking for. So so he has this feature called Playbook on Politico, which is sort of a collection of interesting tidbits and things that are happening in the coming day and what the big news stories and new angles are that are coming up. So I usually look at that. And then most of my information at this point, I would say, comes from a few places online. I mean, sometimes I get the Washington Post and the Wall Street Journal and the Times delivered to my house, though I'll tell you that I don't always look at them. I say I often don't look at the paper edition. But I have a few. I use the Google News Reader, and I look at various websites and blogs that I'm interested in that track either legal issues or internet privacy, like all kinds of different people that are operating in that arena, and I look at that. And then there's various websites for the courts that that I check pretty often. I check most days. I try to check the Federal Register, which you and I have talked about, which is like a totally obscure publication that very, very few reporters in Washington look at. I'm not saying I read the whole thing, but it's available online. It basically comes out every day. And it's like an incredibly dry list of basically official notices from various government agencies, 97% of which are not at all newsworthy and would never be. The trick is that like 3% of them are newsworthy, and sometimes different groups will flag them as being important, and sometimes they don't flag them, and they just sit there for a long time until people find out about them. I mean, one example would be, I think soon after September 11th, Ashcroft gave some order that
October.
You could spy on defense lawyers.
Oh.
That they would be able to conduct surveillance of defense lawyers who were meeting with their clients because it was in the country's national interest or something. And it was just like published in the Federal Register, and nobody, it sat there for like 10 days with nobody, you know, looked at it. It was available for anyone who wanted to look at it. And suddenly came out on the front page of the New York Times, like, oh my God, the Justice Department has said that we can spy on defense lawyers, and the defense bar went into an uproar or whatever. It wasn't my story. I think the Times had it, and I assume someone gave it to them. But so there's news there, but it's just you have to balance. You could spend half your day trying to read all that stuff, and you wouldn't necessarily be able to always discern what the news is.
One of the good stories that you got out of the Federal Register was what was there and was not on the White House website,
right,
or had not been released to reporters.
Right. Well, I just had a feeling things were so haphazard the first few weeks there about when we would get stuff and when briefings would come out and when they would email stuff out. It would come out at 2 in the morning or the following day, and, you know, you just had a sense that things were loosey-goosey, basically. So I decided, you know, the official things that the president does, like signing bills, like signing executive orders, like formal memoranda and declarations, and even things like proclamations, like National Heart Month or whatever, all that stuff from the most important to the most trivial is sent to be published in this Federal Register. And so I figured I ought to look through there. I think we also, maybe you had gotten heard from some people that at least one thing hadn't made it. So I said, well, I'm going to go through and see what presidential stuff is in there for the first 3 or 4 weeks of Obama administration. And sure enough, there were 7 or 8, I think, items up till that point that they'd never released.
Two of them were executive orders.
To the press, yeah. Two of them were formal executive orders. I don't remember the subject matter, but I think one of them was realigning the Domestic Policy Council or something along those lines, which is a pretty important group or considered an important group in the White House. Another was changing some presidential determination from foreign country. And there were a variety of things, some of which were somewhat newsworthy that they just had never told us about. And I don't think they were trying to cover them up. They were just going between the cracks. So I did a piece about that, and suddenly they started emailing some of these things out, you know, or posted them on the website that night. And it was funny because a couple things had been noted by, like, trade press or whatever, like Obama decided to cancel the entire process for how the government reviews regulations. There are certain publications that follow that kind of thing, and some people did notice that. Some AIDS activists, I think, noticed that when they redid the Domestic Policy Council, they eliminated the slot for the AIDS czar or whatever. Mm-hmm. I didn't see that till after I wrote my story, but some random person had noticed it. So some of these things were newsworthy to some people, but they never announced them. They've gotten much better about it since I caught them on it once, then twice. There were actually bills that the president had signed, like legislation that he signed about 2 weeks ago that they didn't announce and have never announced. You would think a bill, like, it's going to go to Congress or come from Congress and be recorded in the law books for eternity, that they might put out a press release saying the president signed.
What are some other things that you read or do as part of news gathering?
In addition to looking at those newsreaders and the Federal Register, there are certain cases that I'm tracking that I'm really interested in that are in the court-specific cases. And so I will look at their dockets a few times a week to just see if there's anything new happening. There's a page on the Federal District Court website here in Washington where you can look at decisions or orders that have come out in the last day or so. They also have a whole section devoted just to the Guantanamo litigation where you can see, again, the same kinds of orders. And it sounds terribly time-consuming, but once you've done it a few times, you can sort of, you don't have to spend more than a minute just looking at it, and you can kind of see, you know, it's pretty easy to distinguish the Guantanamo cases from the run-of-the-mill litigation by looking at, you know, frankly, the names and the, you know, so-and-so. Muhammad versus Bush or versus Obama now, it indicates that the chances are that's a Guantanamo case. So you can go through there and just click on them and see what the judges are saying sort of in real time. There's usually 2 or 3 of those decisions a day. And so I look at some of that and like I said, look through these blogs and so forth where people are reading, commenting on this. This kind of stuff.
I remember during the Louis Libby trial, Fitzgerald decided to put up all of the exhibits, and they were very instructive as to how communications worked in the White House and in the Vice President's office.
Right.
I just found those just fascinating. So there's a lot of information out there that it takes a lot of digging.
Yeah. Well, and we, you know, we live in this era where if stuff is on the internet, it really becomes a question of organizing it and organizing your time to decide what you're going to devote time to looking through. I mean, almost not everything is out there, but a lot of stuff is out there, and sometimes it's such a fire hose of information that it's hard to figure out. It's hard to figure out how to deal with it.
Yeah, that's is true for people in the White House too. I asked Josh Bolton when he was chief of staff how he dealt with, there's so much information out there, but there is so little understanding. And how do you deal with that? And he said that was actually one of the big parts of his job, that that's what he had to do for the president, is try to bring some, synthesize it and bring some understanding to it. Are there blogs or other places that you find that are very good at synthesizing information?
It depends what you mean by synthesize. I mean, the stuff I'm looking at more has to do with, like, raw, you know, they give you more raw information, like somebody who goes and posts whenever they think there's an important decision on some subject matter. The blogs that I check out, some of them are frankly my friends. You know, Mark Halpern, who used to work with at ABC News, has the Page politics blog that tracks stuff and is pretty, they don't do a lot of original reporting there, but they're very quick to point you to important stories that other people are doing. Mark Ambender, who's at The Atlantic, who's another former colleague of mine from ABC, seems to have an incredible range of ability to really to synthesize subjects that are incredibly diverse, that I can't mimic his range, but he seems to have very informed analysis of stuff, both in politics and the legal realm and so forth. So I look at his stuff. He's one of the names in my blog, in my reader, and Ben Smith, our guy that does a politics blog for Politico. I see everything that he does too, because I just think it's very, you know, I feel like he's very sharp on top of what's happening with the White House and so forth.
Do you find that that covering the White House now is very different than it was in covering the Clinton administration? Do you look for different things? What are the similarities and what are the differences? What are the continuities and where are the changes?
I think one big change is, like, email has become a lot more dominant. I've even had White House people complain to me, who some of whom, there are a few that have experience back from that era, and it's just like everything is conducted via email, which is, you know, like you'll fire off questions to somebody in the press office and they'll fire off an answer back to you. And some people don't like it that much because they feel like, especially on certain subjects, you know, even if it's off the record, people in the White House are not comfortable putting down their analysis of someone else's motives. And quite rightly, if I were them in their shoes, I wouldn't in a million years put something like that in an email. But someone may be more comfortable on the phone telling you the same thing. And back when I was covering in the late 90s, you would have done that primarily by phone. Like, if you wanted to get an answer from the National Security Council, or you wanted an answer from some domestic policy issue, you would call the person at the White House and they would call you back. That still goes on, though, frankly, you know, most of the time now it's you pop out a one-sentence question to the person who you think will answer it and you get a, you know, one-sentence answer back. The person I was speaking with complained, and this is a White House person, it makes it harder to convey their message to the press and to try to explain things to people in a more nuanced way so that they can write more informed stories. But the speed of life has just sort of caught up to them in a way that they don't really have to, they feel like they don't have time to call everybody back, even if people wanted to be called. So I feel like that's changed a little bit. There are certainly a few more bloggers running around. I feel like the sense of the crushing deadlines of, you know, around 6 or 7 or 8 o'clock for the newspapers and of 6:30 for the network newscasts, to me, it just doesn't feel as omnipresent as it did. Now, I was working at ABC, so of course it seemed like a bigger deal. And I'm sure if I sat in the ABC booth or the CBS booth or whatever, those deadlines would seem bigger to me. But I feel like everybody is more on a continuous wheel now than, mm-hmm. than we were at that time. I mean, all the networks have their websites and their own blogs, and I think there's a real sense that they, you know, that they understand they have to put stuff out in real time. You can't wait for 6:30 or 8 o'clock. Or mm-hmm. Certainly, especially the newspapers, I think, are aware that if they have a story at 1 p.m, you know, to hold it, to run it the next morning is crazy, and they ought to just put it out when they have it. Mm-hmm. So there's more of that, you know, urgency, I think, than there was in the 90s when I was there. Mm-hmm. I don't know. The other things, I think there are still some issues about the sea legs of the administration, and they're trying to figure out. You know, I arrived in 1997. The Clinton people had 4 years, tumultuous years already, right. You know, where they'd run through as press secretaries and tried a variety of things that failed before they got a bit of a rhythm down for themselves. And I don't think the Obama people have been through that. I've had that full shaking out period. I mean, I understand that I've been listening to people that went on this recent trip to Europe, that they were not at all happy with the way the press was accommodated. I haven't talked to our political person who went, so I'm not actually reflecting his views, but I heard certainly a few reporters saying that it was not, it just was not very, it was incredibly expensive in this era for news organizations to send somebody.
How much do you think it would cost to have sent somebody? That was 8 days,
on
right?
That trip? I mean, I don't know for certain, but I would guess that I would guess that to send one person on that trip probably cost somewhere north of $10,000. I would think probably around 15 or something like that. I could be off a little bit.
Yeah, but, I think it's even more.
But it could be... it could be more. It just depends what hotels they put people in and how much they overpaid for various things. So it could be it could be 20,000. Wouldn't surprise me.
Let's take some questions. Towson, would you like somebody like to ask a question, and then we'll just go back and forth.
Houston, are you there?
Prior to this class, I hadn't really heard of Politico, and do you guys intend to kind of market yourselves more as a mainstream news source in the future, or do you want to remain as in the political circles and just kind of cater to the political science, not political science, but political crowds?
I mean, I'm not the best, as a reporter, I'm not the best person to speak to our marketing strategy. But I do know that as other newspapers have been cutting back, Politico has been trying to sell its political coverage product to individual newspapers. I think Reuters has bought our product. So rather than trying to have a huge political coverage operation of their own in Washington, they're trying to use our stuff and then put it out on their wire. I know there are a bunch of newspaper websites that use Politico's material. I don't think you're going to see a huge like national advertising campaign, because I think Politico's business model is a little different, which is I think every website wants to have as many visitors as they can possibly have. But I think Politico's model is also very focused on who is visiting the site. In other words, if they could tell advertisers that half the people in the White House are on this website every day, that might be a lot more valuable than if they can tell advertisers we can get 100,000 views a day, or you know, so many people in Duluth or Houston or Los Angeles are looking at this website. I mean, I don't think that it is intended to be a mass audience website. I mean, we all want as much traffic as we can get. If people want to read our stories from anywhere in the world, we certainly welcome them, and we'll try to sell ads that will reach them. But I think that as a business, the idea is to try to dominate the Washington political market and to dominate people that are interested in reaching people in the administration, people that are interested in reaching people on Capitol Hill, and to try to provide the most aggressive and interesting coverage of the White House and of Congress. And if it interests people elsewhere in the country, then that's great for us. But I think the main business model is to speak to the people that are directly involved in that debate.
During the campaign, I had a friend who's a reporter who was questioning people in the campaigns, where they got information. And in a typical comment, one person said, "I start my day by reading Politico because what they have is going to drive my day." And that's the kind of model you have. And that's hard in a sense to change from campaigning to governing, to have that same kind of impact in governing. But in part, one of the things that that they did is they had a very strong campaign team, and then they hired David Rogers who had worked at the Wall Street Journal, who's covered Congress and is known for his Congress coverage. They brought him in, David Cloud on intelligence from the New York Times, and then you. So it was the three of you in particular that could deal with governing issues rather than campaign issues. Somebody here have a question? Yeah.
You had mentioned earlier in the interview that with one of your stories, that when you were reporting it back to Politico, that you needed to sort of steer it from a track that Politico wanted it to be on, you know, Bush versus Obama. And I'm wondering, in your opinion, do you think that, say, like the leanings, as I guess we know it, of news organizations, of, you know, Fox is conservative, MSNBC is more liberal, do you think that in any way affects journalistic integrity by saying, like, you can only report certain things in certain ways instead of what you actually believe is happening? Do you think that affects your writings?
Well, I think there's a few different issues there. One, I hope I didn't make it sound like they were trying to tell me that it should be like pro-Bush or pro-Obama. It was not that. It was that there's a tendency coming out of the campaign to view everything in the mindset of, I mean, people forget it was actually McCain who was running, Obama ran against, not Bush, but in any event, that there's that.
For part of the year.
Yeah, there's that way of viewing the world, that it's all a struggle between these two opposing forces. And so I think unless the reporters argue strongly that it needs to be approached in a different way, the default assumption is that the story would fit, that almost every story fits into that. Especially any story of a conflict somehow fits into that struggle, big partisan struggle. So in terms of the other question, though, about like leanings and what people want you to cover versus what you cover, I mean, look, that's the job of editors, right, to discuss with you what stories they think you should be doing. And if you're a good reporter, you're always telling them what stories you think you should be doing and what you think the best angle is. And so, you know, if I want to just write exactly what I want to write without input from anybody else, I can just set up a blog and blog to my heart's content. I do think that usually the stories get better, especially in terms of adding context that makes stuff more interpretable. Like sometimes, you know, I think one of my colleagues called my reporting arcane yesterday. So some of that may be, you know, if I'm going to talk about the latest development in the fight over Guantanamo versus Bagram, you have the constant issue of, like, how much background do I need to explain that Bush opened Guantanamo because, you know, they wanted to put these people beyond the reach of the law, and they had too many of them in Afghanistan. Do you know? So you don't know. If you do that, if you lay out the whole story, you have no room for what just happened. And so it's a constant struggle over, like, how much background to put in. So, I mean, I do think that there are news organizations that have particular political agendas that they're, or more often though, markets. Like, you know, I think that there are some news organizations that are pitching their stories to an audience that thinks about things a certain way. And therefore they move their reporting in that direction. Sometimes that audience thinks about things from a certain political standpoint. Sometimes it's a certain economic class that they represent, or a certain other niche of society. So I don't know. I mean, my feeling is always that I think there's more biases. I think the most serious and problematic biases that reporters have are not on the ideological spectrum, but are often more in the economic realm, you know, and just various other things that prevent certain stories from taking off. That people always scream like bias or partisan bias when, you know, there's things like kids' soccer game bias. You know, like if an event is happening at the time of some reporter's kids' soccer game, it's not going to get covered. And it sounds funny, but they're seriously, especially at this time when, you know, news staffs are really shrinking on certain beats, there are only a few reporters covering things. And if one guy's assigned here and one guy's on vacation and the other guy has a kid's soccer game, a very important story might get missed. And it really has nothing to do with whether the reporters are, I mean, most reporters want to break stories that will be newsworthy, that will get attention and pickup. And I don't think they're intentionally coming at it from a point of view of trying to score particular partisan points. Most. I'm not saying some of them. There are definitely people who are, you know, and there's a whole branch of journalism that has cropped up in the last 10 years to give places for people who have a particular ideological viewpoint to talk about the news, to report on the news. And, I mean, that is what it is. I mean, I think people have figured out that it's a good business proposition, and as long as it's a good business proposition, people will do it. I don't think we need to get, like, incredibly bent out of shape over it, because the history of the country is that journalism has been far more warped over time than it is today, even in some of the most warped places you can find it. So, you know, I'm not the hugest fan of it, but at the same time, I don't get too worried about it.
Mm-hmm. Timing has always been a thing too with the White House. The White House tries to work with that, the notion that at a particular time during the day or during the week, there are going to be fewer reporters that are going to be covering something, and that's why you get document drops at the end of a Friday. You know, when they want to put in a story,
right?
They have to put it out, but they don't want people to cover it.
West Wing had an episode where they referred to it as taking out the trash on Friday. So, where there were documents that had some negative stuff in them, or they were going to put out word that, like, some senior staffer had gone into rehab or something like that, and they'd push it out, try to taking out the trash, which, you know, it really, it does happen, you know, and it even with the Obama administration, it's happened, you know.
Yeah.
This Bagram thing came out late Friday, you know, and even some things that aren't trash, you don't quite know. Sometimes they seem to just bury it into the, you know, that they were going to release 250,000 pages of Reagan era records. I thought it was sort of a good news story, but maybe it looks like a snub or something. I'm not sure, but sure enough, they decide to announce that at 4:55 p.m. on Friday.
Yeah.
Why? I don't really
One
know.
Of the good examples of that principle was in the Clinton administration. They had to give documents, and these included the first 5 minutes of meetings that were video,
right,
that the White House Communications Agency had,
yep,
taken, the videos that they had done at fundraisers that,
right,
the president had attended with people who had been involved in fundraising. And they had to give all this material to the Hill. So what they did was they figured they would give it to the press first, but they didn't want to make a big deal of it. So on a Friday, when the president was traveling out of Washington and where much of the press corps was going to be with him.
John Solomon, AP. That's where it would usually show up, I feel like. Yeah. You'd get the John Solomon AP.
And so what they did is they strung together all of these five-minute statements. And they told reporters if they wanted to see it, they could go over to the old executive office building, to the Indian Treaty room, and those things would be, they would all be played.
Yeah.
So I went over at about 4 o'clock, figuring that they would have the worst at around that time.
Right.
And it was true. They did. And they had one where they were talking about raising, about soft money, which is not to be used in any partisan purposes. And Clinton was talking about how they had used it to develop this image that the Republicans were responsible for the government shutdown, which is absolutely not a proper use of soft money. And they played that at about 4:30 when they expected nobody was there. There were 3 reporters there, and they were investigative reporters from the New York Times.
Lanny Davis used to put that stuff out, and the paper would come out, and the ones where the president had wrote about the Lincoln bedroom and start the $50,000 donors right away, and that would all be handed out, either in the Indian Treaty Room or it would be just given to the Associated Press, for release late on a Friday, afternoon, to be, and then it goes into the Saturday papers, which tends to be the thinnest and least widely read. Newspaper, but there are people that are this Bagram. I think people are getting wise to it over time, and so the Bagram thing, even though it came on Friday, and I don't know if that was because of the deadline or because they deliberately were trying to bury it, it got a little attention, but very little. I think that the Times had a Saturday piece about 4 inches long with no byline in it, but. The Monday Times had an editorial calling Bagram the next Guantanamo. So people sort of woke up to it, and I saw Rachel Maddow's show did a segment about where she was outraged about it, and that they weren't going to, just because it came out on Friday, they were determined not to let them off the hook. So, every action has a reaction. I guess some people are catching on to the scheme.
Towson?
Oftentimes we get information from people you know. Have you ever covered a story that you didn't really know anything about or anyone about? And if so, how did you get, obtain information quickly?
I don't know if I'm going to be able to think of any good examples on the spot. But there are always things that come up in the White House. I think, one of the reasons they have me over there is to write sort of stories that come up. I'm not like a huge budget expert, but they'll throw me into doing the budget and economics stories. I think some of it is just, if you've had the experience of being around, especially on the White House beat, if you've done it for a while, there is a certain rhythm to it. And that they do the budget in, January or February, they put it out, and there's, the format that it comes out in and how they brief people about it. I don't know if I can give you a really good answer about being thrown into something where you didn't know, you don't know exactly what you're covering, although I will say that I went to cover the Olympics for the New York Sun last summer, and I had to cover a badminton match. And I did my best to read the little booklet. I had no idea what the rules are. I don't know. I know a badminton. I'm not stupid, but I've never seen a competitive badminton match, and I don't know.
Yeah, those
when
are really competitive.
When the guy swats it, do you say, he took a good swing at it, or how many words are there for the little whiffle thing, the birdie or whatever it is? It's, what words are you allowed to use? So I wrote this up the best I could. It was very funny. We went to see it because it was the Americans, who were ranked 27th, facing off, I think, against the Chinese, who were ranked number one or number two. So it was a total humiliation of these two American guys. So it was funny in that respect, but they were proud to do at least as well as they did, and that while they got humiliated, they weren't like horribly humiliated. And then it was kind of funny, the Chinese were chanting, you know, were saying, I don't remember what it was, but it was something kind of nasty, like, I mean, they were going to be, these guys were going to get beaten anyway, so it didn't seem necessary.
Rub it in.
So I sent the story into the editor, and I've never written a badminton story before, so if I didn't use the right terminology, you know, I hope you'll fix it or whatever, and the editor just laughed at some considerable length and said, Josh, we've never run a badminton story before, so, you know, I have no idea what the, we'll just run it however you wrote it. So, I don't know, you just, you know, you occasionally find yourself in this place where you have to write something you have no particular experience covering, but, you know, just hope for the best. I think I got to cover some fancy,
let's have let's take the young woman here, and then we'll take you. So you're doing guys. I'm always criticizing when the president does. I remember in a press conference that Clinton had, he was almost all the way through, and all of a sudden he recognized that he'd called on nothing but men, and so then he
swerved.
Yeah.
You mentioned the changes taking place in the news industry, and
right.
A lot of agencies are downscaling. How do you see the future of the news industry, and what advice would you give to an aspiring journalist? How could someone get a start in this field?
I don't know. I mean, I don't want to sound too depressing. I think it's like a really difficult time right now. I think what's happening, particularly at the medium-sized kind of regional newspapers, is terrible, and it's bad for the country. It's bad for the newspapers. It's bad for the communities where those newspapers are. But I don't see any obvious answer to it. I also think that there's a bad polarization going on between media that costs a ton of money for people to buy and stuff that's free. I mean, in a sense, it's a natural effect of what's happening right now. You've got a lot of more people giving away free stuff than should be by any logical sense. I mean, by which I mean pretty much every newspaper gives away all their stories for free on the internet. And they kind of have to because everybody else is doing it. And if you don't, then you just look stupid and you just reduce your own traffic. But then you have this other mode that's cropping up and getting bigger and bigger, which is things like Bloomberg, where people pay tens of thousands of dollars a year to have these terminals that have their Bloomberg news. You do get some of it free on the internet, but most of it is in these terminals. And then you have the really expensive Washington news services like CQ and like Congress Daily and things like this. And it really affects things. I mean, I did this story a few weeks ago about a hearing on the Hill where they were proposing this legislation to basically, that would affect how the First Lady can work in terms of how open the process has to be if she does any official work. And I happened to be sent a video of this congressional hearing, a link to it, and I watched it, and the Democrats are all like, this is an attack on the First Lady, and you need to think this over, and you need to back off, or the president's going to come after you, because his family, you know, he's very protective of his family. I mean, it almost sounded like a bar fight, like I was watching two people who were about to slug it out in a bar. And I was like, this is extraordinary. This must have been written about. And I Googled and Googled, and there's nothing. And eventually, I was like, well, I better check Nexus. So I go on Nexus and found out that both CQ and Congress Daily had written it up, you know, maybe not as in a lively way as I might have liked, but they basically reported it, which I think is a pretty important and interesting story about the First Lady. But unless you subscribe, unless you're a paid subscriber to CQ or Congress Daily, or you want to go look at it in the library or something, you didn't know that. I mean, it never made it into, like, the public debate. I mean, despite all the talk of everything's on the internet and, you know, there's a free exchange and there's a million bloggers, this wasn't out there. I mean, it was reported. Two paid reporters sat there and reported it, and it went off into Congress Daily and CQ, never to be heard from again. And so, like, 3 weeks after it happened, I did, like, a blog post to sort of lift the veil on this thing. And suddenly, like, it's linked everywhere, and the congressman's denouncing me that I was stirring up trouble and all kinds of other things. So you have that weird separation going on in the media, this wall with all the paid media and people that can afford to pay for it and everything else that's free. In terms of what's going to happen in the future, I have to assume that there's going to be some effort to make people pay in some respect for the information that they're getting, that they're largely getting free now. But I honestly can't explain to you how we're going to get from the way the system is now to whatever system that looks like in the future. In terms of what young people should do that are interested in getting into the field, I don't know. I mean, all these places aren't going out of business. I mean, the major TV networks are not going to go out of business. The biggest of the newspapers are not going to go out of business. If these medium and smaller papers do go out, they may be replaced. In other words, there's talk that the papers in Seattle or Atlanta, even Boston, might go out of business. If they do, they're not just going to disappear altogether. Something else will come back into, do you know what I mean, to take that place, because it's like a vacuum. I'm concerned that whatever comes back in won't be as good as those papers were. And I'm concerned that those papers are already not as good as they were 5 or 10 years ago. So I don't know that that's great advice. My general advice is that I think, you know, internships are like a great way to like see how things are done and to get, get contacts and so forth. And that's, you know, I must have done 5 before I actually got a job. But, you know, I feel like you learn by doing a lot better than practicing it. Classroom, as far as journalism goes.
Mm-hmm.
Towson? You talked about transparency.
Yeah.
What do you think is the administration's knowledge, and what is public knowledge?
Can you give your question over again?
One more time.
You've talked about transparency. What do you think is the administration's knowledge versus public knowledge?
You mean what should they be able to keep private, you mean, and what should they, you know, what does the public have a right to know? Is that what you're asking me?
Yeah, or like, is the Obama administration being too much like the Bush administration, not giving out enough detail?
Well, I mean, they may not be giving out a lot of detail so far because maybe they haven't done all that much. So that's one possibility. I think that they're... promises to be transparent are still only partially fulfilled. I mean, I did a piece talking about that, giving them a report card on various things. I think that some things, they tell us more about the president's schedule than they told us, I think, under President Bush about what the president was doing, or even under President Clinton. But they don't tell us quite as much as they promised. I mean, they made pretty, again, Obama made really sweeping promises. He said that, like, every time, you know, anyone that, the White House is the people's house, and the public has the right to know who visits it. And he said that in the context of sort of like anyone coming to advocate on behalf of a specific cause or to lobby, that ought to be public. Well, I haven't seen anything approaching that level of detail of who's coming in or out. I know they're working. They have an initiative on transparency and openness. They're gathering a lot of ideas about how to make the government more open. I think they have a long way to go. And like I said, the first really interesting test of this, and this I basically took from something Michael Isikoff was saying a few weeks ago, will be, what does the Obama administration show us about their own decision making? What do they show us about things that could interfere with their own goals? Releasing memos that John Yoo wrote at the Justice Department 7 years ago about why he thinks the Constitution can be suspended for the military to shoot terrorists on American streets is fascinating to me. It's fascinating to historians and civil libertarians, but it comes at no expense whatsoever to Obama. And so I think the real test of transparency is going to be when you show something that it's going to hurt him or could hamper something he wants to do, but he's insists on doing it in a transparent way, even if it has that effect. And I haven't seen anything like, I don't know if Mark has seen anything that makes that standard, but I haven't seen anything yet that makes that standard.
Yeah. I think it's very difficult. You know, once they get in, I mean, who wants to release something that that gives somebody else some control over what it is they're doing? Oh. Information. You hold the information.
Right. I mean, we've already seen at the Justice Department Holder. There was a fight over D.C. statehood rights, and Holder didn't like the opinion one set of lawyers drafted, so he called the Solicitor General and asked for another opinion. And now they're saying that the opinions that were given to Holder, they're not going to release them. It's all internal deliberations, even though there's something to indicate that, you know, once they write an opinion, it's a set opinion and it's not an internal deliberation. They won't put it out. So, you know, I think their report card is not a terribly positive one so far, but there's some signs of things being better, but it could go a lot further. Mm-hmm. We'll see.
Young man in back. I said we have a question. Oh, okay. All righty. Another question then? Somebody else here have a question? Yeah.
I'm going to ask a slightly, I hope it doesn't come off as,
I got the mic. Okay. So I'm going to ask a question. I hope it doesn't come off as belligerent. But,
That's a nice introduction.
Yeah.
Yeah, well, actually, I worked in ICE's office.
Uh-huh.
I work in ICE's office,
yeah.
So... Yeah, no, I had to take a lot of those calls.
Oh, so you know about my story.
That was a lot of fun.
Right.
no, it wasn't. But what would you say to accusations that Politico or other kind of new news media, in an attempt to attract attention, engages in a little bit of sensationalism, just generally not necessarily referring to your piece or anything else?
I mean, that was the theme, I think, of this Howie Kurtz story yesterday in the Post, too.
Yeah.
You know, I think there's a continuum between, like, stories that are really boring and sensationalism. Mm. I think that, like, if I write an item like the one on that hearing went on for something like more than an hour. I think the chunk talking about this particular issue was 30 to 45 minutes long or something like that. Mm-hmm. It was pretty long. I listened to it a few times, actually. I don't know. Am I supposed to listen through the whole thing and present the story as a list of, you know, so-and-so said this, had these five good points, and this other person had these five good points? Or am I supposed to look for what I thought was the most interesting thing that happened, which was this Democratic congressman who was like, you're picking a fight with the first lady and the president, and the president's going to look for you and you need to be careful, and he's like pointing his finger like, you need to be careful, watch out what you're doing. The president, like, it doesn't like attacks on his family, which to me, again, it sounded to me the way it was delivered, like two guys in a bar that, you know, were about to need to be separated for some reason. Now, I'm not saying the whole hearing was like that, and a lot of it was sort of a more mundane kind of back and forth.
Sure.
But, yeah, I think you'll see what our editors said in that Post piece. If the accusation is, do we try to present the most interesting story that we can and put the most interesting part first?
Mm-hmm.
You know, do we put the dessert before the main course sometimes, mm-hmm. you know? Sure. Mm-hmm. I don't think that's like a horrible crime. The other thing on this specific story I would say is we didn't say that it was an attack on the First Lady. That was the way that these Democrats at this hearing were describing it.
Yeah, so, no, I mean, a lot so, of, yeah.
So then what happens is, you know, people that read stuff on the internet, and you can look at the comments on Politico's website, many of them are so polarized that they view everything written by anyone as an attempt to score a point for one side or the other. So therefore, there are a bunch of you know, liberals who see this, or Democrats who see this proposal, and they're like, they're trying to, you know, mess with the First Lady and destroy her, yeah. you know. And they're like, well, we were proposed this last year when nobody had any idea who the First Lady was going to be, and, you know, a lot of valid counterarguments. And on the other side, you know, when we write about it, my sense was that the ICE's office and other Republicans thought some Democrat put us up to, like, write about it. I mean, I don't know. Congress Daily and CQ wrote about it. No one put them up to write about it. It just, if you listen to that hearing, this is by far the most interesting part. So,
yeah.
So I don't think we should apologize for putting the most interesting part of the story at the top, like the old inverted pyramid school of journalism. I think that's the way you're supposed to do it. But I do think that there's a legitimate point that we look at things sometimes solely through conflict, and if there's no conflict, we don't think there's any story. Sometimes mm-hmm. things are, even when there's no fight over them, it's still a totally legitimate story. Sometimes we need to provoke a fight over certain things, even when people aren't paying attention to them. But I mean, sure, you know, one of the things Politico tries to do is to write stories, political related stories, in a snazzier way, in an edgier way, that attracts more attention. I mean, all I can say to that is, like, there are plenty of other things people could be doing on the internet that are far less value to society than reading, you know, reading Politico stories, even the more sure. outlandish ones. So, you know, I think some of it is just the way the internet works and the way things are. But I think, you know, we also, anyone who goes there, there's plenty of boring stories. No, I'm just kidding. There's no boring stories, but there are plenty of serious and substantive stories. Yeah. And if people jump for the ones that are edgier and lighter, you know, I don't know. The Post has a style section. You know, most papers have a sports section and a style section. They often want to lecture us about, like, that we, you know, we're concentrating on things that are trivial. I don't remember them telling us they're going to, like, throw the style section and the sports section in the trash and only do the most serious and weighty matters of American democracy. Is that a good enough defense of Politico?
Yeah. yeah. And I promised you could, you were sprung at 7:30
right.
that he has to pick up his daughter.
I do.
And,
if there's any other
much.
Urgent pressing things, I'm happy to tackle them otherwise.
Yeah. Thank you very much.
Thank you. That was good.